From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Mark Spitz is my guest. He is a novelist, as well as a playwright, and a music critic and historian, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, Spin, Maxim, and all over the place. His latest book is a biography of someone named Mick Jagger. Mark Spitz has written about punk, Green Day, and David Bowie. His new book is Jagger, Rebel, Rockstar, Rambler, Rogue. And it's a wonderful commentary on Mick Jagger's life and times. Mark Spitz, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I like the way you chose interesting points in Jagger's career to kind of focus on as milestones in his life. I don't think they're the ones that necessarily people would think of. It was a cool way of telling the story. One that struck me was As Tears Go By. You think of that as really a major moment in his career?
Yes, I do. Well, first of all, obviously, it's what you said is true. I took real care to sort of target the moments in his life that I wanted to focus on, and didn't sort of want to have the pressure to cover everything. A, because it's been done before, many times before, and B, because I don't think I don't think you make the best sort of argument that way. Because I wanted to give myself a little bit of leeway and maybe not be bound to sort of the kind of objectivity that some biographies are sort of bound to. I wanted to maybe have the freedom to have more of an opinionated voice in the narrative. So,
and I guess that might be a problem if you hated Mick Jagger. I mean, I've read recently some opinionated Paul McCartney biographies that really annoy me. But you love Mick Jagger.
Well, the trick, I think, is to be fair, is to have the courage to call him out if there's parts where you realize that he's just not either being just a good guy, or parts where he's just I write about parts where he just literally, I don't know what the term is, makes a cuckold of friends of his.
Yes.
And I'm not saying, oh, well, that's just Mick. He's just being Mick.
He just sleeps with your wife or your girlfriend.
Right, exactly. Well, you just ran off with my girlfriend. It's not biased one way or the other. It's just kind of if anything, the thesis is just generally contrary. Why do we think this way? Why is he not as cool as Keith? Why is he this or that, or has become this or that? As all figures who've been around as long as he has, I think his cool factor sort of ebbs and flows, and I think it was in a low point when I started the book, and it looks like it's sort of picking up lately.
Well, I'm going to assume that you started writing your book before Keith's book.
Yeah, no, I think that I was kind of hoping for the best when it came to Keith's book. It was a rumor.
Right.
And
will it ever actually happen? Yeah.
Is, well, what on earth would Keith Richards remember? It's like, I don't remember half the people who I'm friends with on Facebook, and apparently I went to college with, a quarter of them. It's like, and I've not done nearly as many drugs as Keith Richards.
Let's
hope
not.
The quality of the drugs you can afford if you're Keith Richards, it speaks volumes, because he obviously had total recall.
Yeah.
But to your point, life was a rumor. Life was under armed guard, at the publishers. No one could see it. No one could read it. It was like, I was just sort of wondering, okay, I was like a three quarters of the way done with my book. And I was just wondering, okay, I hope I don't read it. When I finally did, and I bought it like everyone else at the bookstore, and I said, well, I hope there's nothing in here that's going to completely torpedo some of my theses, because I liked where the book was going already at that point. And I think the best case scenario kind of proved out, because it was a great book, and B, it got a lot of interest sort of refocused on the Mick Keith dynamic, and also was a little snippy in places, and kind of reinforced what I was sort of trying to disprove or prove about where Mick was in the culture.
Yeah. So to talk a little bit about some of these, let's start with As Tears Go By. Why is As Tears Go By an important one?
Oh, right. Okay, so back to your original question.
Right.
Chairs go by.
Yeah, right. Mark, feel free to ignore my questions. Most of my
that
guests,
obviously, yeah. is the first Jagger Richards composition. It's the first effort they made at songwriting. Before that, they were pretty much a covers band, doing, you know, albeit amazing versions of, you know, already sort of well-established blues artist songs, and even a Beatles song, you know, a Lennon McCartney song, I Want to Be Your Man. This was the sort of leap into just a new frontier, and it allowed them to keep pace with peers like Lennon McCartney and Ray Davies and Pete Townsend and sort of American pop masters like Brian Wilson, who were, and Dylan, obviously, who were just really driving the popular song into the giddy stratospheres at the time, 64, 65, 66. You know, I mean, you could still say that's like the peak of modern popular music. It just in terms of what came out, you know, what Revolver and Pet Sounds and you know, albums that routinely top your best ever lists. So the Stones weren't in the league, you know, at the time. You know, they'd had a couple of hits. They had the Screaming Girls, but they weren't what you would call artists or songwriters. You know, they were just a great live band. As Tears Go By, which they wrote at the behest of their manager at the time, Andrew Oldham, for Marianne Faithfull, a teenage Marianne Faithfull, famously, who they met at a party, kind of changed everything. It revealed a sensitive side, so much so that they were reluctant initially to show, Mick and Keith were reluctant to show it to Brian Jones and the other members of the band because they thought it was a quote-unquote chick song.
I sit and watch as tears go by. My riches can't buy everything. I want to hear the children sing. All I hear is the sound of rain falling on the ground. I sit and watch as tears go by.
What do you think it says about Mick Jagger that, you know, that his first foray into songwriting was such a sensitive song?
Well, I think that the and Keith as well. I mean, if you listen, the chords are really melancholy and sophisticated. And you know, Marianne Faithfull has said, she told me that, you know, that she was sort of lucky to get just this kind of beautiful, complex song. But at, you know, even earlier when she wrote her own memoir, she said that it was pretty much astonishing that this would come out of somebody so young, much less a man, because it has that sort of almost novelistic, almost literary quality to it. You know, it's a highly melancholy lyrical narrative, and it's just it's sort of to hear mixing it today. When he's sort of caught up to that age is really remarkable when you think that he first recorded it himself in the mid 60s, because it was just so he credibly put himself in the mind of someone whose soul was sort of, you know, weary and there's that ache there that, like, I don't think someone who's 22 years old is going to be able to. You'd have to be a prodigy. You'd have to be almost like someone who's channeling the spirit of others. And I guess there is an element to that in blues singers and just great soul singers. You know, you do sort of channel. So maybe that was there. But then, you know, he wrote the thing. I mean, he doesn't really get. I don't think he ever gets credit for his songwriting.
Yeah.
In the same way that a Dylan or a Brian Wilson or McCartney.
Lennon McCartney. Well, yeah. We're talking with Mark Spitz, not the Olympic swimmer, but rather the.
Yes, I did a lot of radio today, and there was one, I think, in I want to say Grand Rapids. No, it's not Roanoke. Somebody literally thought they were talking to the Olympic swimmer, talking to me.
Well, he has.
Like I changed career paths midlife and decided to become a rock and roll biographer.
He has a K, and you have a C at the end of your name. You also talk a bit about Altamont as a major turning point, and I think many people register Altamont as the, you know, kind of the end of the hippie dream, the dark side of Woodstock and so forth.
Right.
But what do you think it says about Mick Jagger?
Altamont is complicated, and I knew that I would have to kind of find a new way of looking at it and focus on it, because you can't really better the film Gimme Shelter by the Maisels brothers, and I was lucky enough to interview Albert Maisels for the book, and Stanley Booth's book, which was it's just a chilling account of it. Stanley Booth was a guy embedded with the Stones on their 69 tour, and wrote a book called True Adventures of the Rolling Stones, which is not only, I think, the best book written about the Rolling Stones, but it might be like the best book written about just rock and roll. So I knew that like I had the benefit of time passing and hindsight, and also something that Mr. Maisel said to me. He said, two things, actually. There was a English writer named Mick Farren, who's a self-styled anarchist and radical from the 60s, and I interviewed him, and he said that was the moment where it was like the emperor's new clothes, and Mick just looked like an old drag queen up there who couldn't control anything, But then I talked to Mr. Maisels afterwards, and he was like, yeah, but you wouldn't even be able to see that footage because Mick had to sign off on it, So that like made me think, yes, it was like a low point. Yes, it showed him scared and losing power, and you could read any kind of symbolism into it in terms of the end of a generation or the utopian sort of hippie ideal. But the document itself was something that clearly Mick and Keith and the Stones kind of wanted you to see. They could have put it in a vault. So I think it takes like a brave and complex soul to allow that to kind of give and also really sort of respectful of Meredith Hunter, the fan who was killed. He might have been completely lost to history. We might not even know his name now if this thing was just kind of, if the kibosh was put on it. So yes, it's a low point, but it's also kind of weirdly a kind of noble moment that was, I think, heretofore sort of unsung, and I was kind of, that was like kind of the moment in the book that sort of changed things for me, when I realized that there were new ways of looking at things that were so fixed. Like rock and roll is supposed to be about freedom and progressive thinking, but I've worked within it a long time, and there's a lot of fixed ideas, So I guess part of my job with this book was to sort of challenge some of them.
We're talking with Mark Spitz, and his latest book is called Jagger, Rebel, Rockstar, Rambler, Rogue. It sounds like That's Life by Frank Sinatra. I've been a rebel,
right,
a rockstar,
right.
A rambler.
Pawn and a king.
I've read a lot about Mick and the Stones, but I never heard anybody talk about You're So Vain as interestingly as you do in the book. Talk a little bit about You're So Vain.
Okay, well, the thing about You're So Vain is that when everyone talks about it, they talk about who the song is about, right? Is it Warren Beatty? Is it James Taylor?
I think it's me. I always thought it was about me. I was pretty sure it was
about you.
Yeah.
Is it, is it Mick? They even wonder, because he sings on it, although he's not credited. Obviously, it's him. It's unmistakably his voice. I wanted to talk about, how the song came to be, Like, that's almost never discussed, and it's such a wonderful song. We all sort of know it. It's on the radio, and it's the kind of thing that you don't turn the station. It's always nice to hear it. It's aged very well. It was one of the biggest hits of the 70s, and it sort of it sort of propelled Mick beyond the Stones in a way. You know, I mean, it was his first sort of the first real case of him stepping outside of the sort of circle. So I, you know, when I got a chance to, I was lucky enough to speak to Carly Simon for the book, and that's kind of what I focused on, is, you know, the mechanics of it and the chemistry and why they discovered, they shared such a sort of magical moment in the studio, how it came to be. Was it sexual chemistry? Did they have an affair? Or was it just pure, kismet?
One of the things that you pay attention to in the book that was, again, kind of a surprise, and you spend a lot of time talking about it, is the Ruddles, the famous movie, All You Need Is Cash.
Yes. Something, again, that's passed over by a lot of Mick biographers. I think it's very important to give him credit for basically inventing the meta rock and roll moment. know, for those of you who don't know, The Ruddles is a documentary from 1978, kind of spearheaded by Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live and Eric Idle of Monty Python, and Neil Innes, who plays the sort of John Lennon figure of the band. The Ruddles are a sort of a takeoff on the Beatles, and Mick Jagger and Paul Simon appear in the film as Mick Jagger and Paul Simon in a world where there are no Beatles. There is just the Ruddles. So they relate real stories from their past of interacting with the Ruddles in terms of things that actually happened with the Beatles. And Mick just seems to be so happy to just puncture the 60s myth and take all these sacred cows and just lead them out to the slaughterhouse. I mean, he just seems, he's not a guy who likes to look back in general, I'm gathering.
You got to walk and don't look back.
Yeah, and he just can't seem to, like, you know, keep a straight face. But at the same time, his comic timing is nearly perfect. And if you see some of the skits that he's done over the years on Saturday Night Live, most famously where he played Keith to Mike Myers' Mick. I mean, or when he played himself across from Jimmy Fallon in the Mirror. He's just game, you know, and I think that he gets kind of dismissed as a sort of humorless, miserly figure, but he definitely has a jolly side, you know, that I kind of wanted to explore. Plus, I think the thing about, we were talking about Altamont, I point this out in the book, that, like, you really can't, like, it, you really do need the satire to fully get past a moment, you know, and I interviewed Neil Innes, from the Ruddles, and he said it was one of the things that George Harrison, who also appears in the film, but not as himself, was so grateful for, because it was like the Ruddles was the moment that they could finally laugh at Beatlemania and the 60s and the sort of dashed dreams of the 60s, because enough time had passed, almost 10 years had passed.
And they do, as you point out in the book, it's a loving skewering of the Beatles.
It's like note perfect. I mean, some of the recreations are astounding.
And of course, Neil Innes was in the Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah, and worked with McCartney on the Urban Spaceman for the Bonzo Dog Band. I mean, he was there, mm-hmm. and some of the songs that he wrote
They're great.
Were so good that there was like there were rumors that like McCartney was actually kind of a little pissed off. You know.
You talk about Saturday Night Live quite a bit. I think you should write about Saturday Night Live. I want to talk about Mick's solo career a little bit. You talk about an unreleased blues album. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Mick was in L.A. in the early 90s. He'd obviously been touring the Steel Wheels record all over the world, and it was their great comeback, and it sort of changed the model for the rock and roll juggernaut tour. And then he sort of, this was like, I guess, the dawn of alternative rock, and rock and roll was getting a little bit less slick and kind of getting a little bit more raw again. And so, you know, he was right in the pocket in terms of the zeitgeist, and he did a record of blues covers, some of his old favorite blues songs, with a Hollywood bar band called the Red Devils. And it was just, he jumped up on stage with them at a bar called the King King that they were kind of the house band at. And then the Red Devils were kind of one of the bands that Rick Rubin, the producer Rick Rubin, was nurturing at the time. And so he got them all together in the studio, and they cut a full album. And the Red Devils were basically just paid like day players. You know, they were just paid to play behind Mick.
Is it Mick playing the harmonica on those tracks?
Yeah, it's Mick playing the harmonica. It's Mick singing, and it's the band, who was a great band, backing him up. Widely bootlegged, it's not really hard to find. There's even some clips on YouTube. I can't vouch for the sound quality, but it remains unreleased. And I think that it's definitely worthy of being released. It's not like one of those things that you would have to clean up significantly. You know, I mean, it's Rick Rubin. I mean, it sounds professional.
Yeah.
But he ended up releasing instead an actually a great record called Wandering Spirit the following year. But that's certainly more of a pop-minded or pop-soul album. It's the kind of blues album that I think if he'd released it, he would have gotten credit perhaps for... Maybe having a sense of anticipating bands like the Black Keys or the White Stripes and their success with a similar sort of sound. You know, it's like punky blues rock. I guess the Gun Club were another kind of big band in LA at the time who were playing a similar kind of music, which is great. I mean, he just, for some reason, maybe he'll decide to release it. I interviewed the guitar player, Paul Size, who was, I think, 18 at the time, or a teenager, like a really young Texas blues rock prodigy. And he didn't even know who Mick Jagger was, you know. He'd never heard, he was just like, if the guy's white, then I'm not into him. You know, he was like a blues purist, and has since become a Stones fan. only after, like, literally making a record with Mick Jagger did he go back and listen to the music. So, but yeah, but Wandering Spirit, a lot of people consider that record too the finest Stones solo project, and I tend to agree. The other solo stuff, you know, you forget that She's the Boss was a big hit record. Like, maybe the legacy of it hasn't aged so well. Primitive Cool, maybe best left, you know, where it is.
And, in the remainder bin.
Yeah, although I kind of developed a little bit of a weird affection for Let's Work, the single.
Uh-huh.
It just sort of grew on me slowly. And the Goddess in the Doorway, or Keith Richards dismissed as Dog, S-H-I-T, in the doorway. I think that suffers from just like a weird compulsion to be relevant. You know, I think it's one of his more frustrating qualities to people it with Lenny Kravitz or Wyclef or Rob Thomas because they have made hit records and they are, you know, younger pop stars of the moment. You know, I think that someone like Keith would say you don't need that, and I sort of tend to agree. You know, what's wrong with just Mick Jagger singing? You know, but that was not a bad record either. All that said, you know, and that was why I interviewed him for Spin. And I thought that record was going to do better, but it didn't sell very well. And surely, within a year, he was back on the road playing with the Stones.
Do you think Kesha's fans know who they're talking about, who she's talking about when she says we'll kick them to the curb unless they look like Mick Jagger?
Well, that's the thing, man. Like we talked before about life and how that was like not really part of the dialogue at the time.
Yeah.
Neither was the rhyme, you know. Neither was the swagger phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
Like that sort of, you know, it did exist. You know, I mean, the Ghostface Killah song was out. The Kanye rap had been, you know, recorded as well. But I think it took Kesha to kind of, you know, make it go sort of supernova in terms of the popular vernacular, and now it's like it's a thing. You know, it's like you've got Maroon 5 on one coast topping the charts. You've got this woman Cher Lloyd, who's like a young sort of whatever the British equivalent of American Idol is contestant has a song that topped the British charts. You know, and it's a great rhyme. I mean, it's better than, you know, Fire and Desire or whatever. I mean, you know, at least there's a new thing that you can sort of.
Well, I'm sure that Kesha is attracted to 70-ish men who have craggy faces.
I would like to send Kesha a copy of my book.
If
anyone out there has Kesha, a way to get to Kesha, I could probably find her through my.
Yeah, wait a minute. You've got contacts, right? The man we're speaking to is Mark Spitz, and his book.
I would sign the S with a dollar sign on Spitz.
Yeah, absolutely.
I signed it.
And the book that you should all read, and you'll enjoy it a lot. It's called Jagger, Rebel, Rockstar, Rambler, Rogue. Mark Spitz, we got a lot more to say about your book, so maybe you'll come back and talk about it again.
Oh, yeah, anytime, and thanks so much for reading it and having interest in it. I'm really proud of it, and I hope it gets some readers.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank Mark Spitz for being my guest. His latest book is called Jagger, Rebel, Rockstar, Rambler, Rogue. The production of From the Bookshelf is aided and abetted by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.